Sherry Ellingson is a first-generation Persian-American who moved here at the age of 8. She's a certified life coach and a 200-hour yoga teacher. Sherry's focus is to help people reach mind, body, and emotional freedom. She specializes in self-care, anxiety management, mindfulness, supporting college students in their lives, and premarital coaching, and more. Skylar Rosalini graduated from SMC in 2007 with a communications degree and has grounded their professional career as a lawyer with the LaSallian principles of SMC. Rosalini spoke to 30 current students about navigating the work space for the place of a marginalized identity, a skill set Rosalini has mastered while practicing law and showing up authentically. Rosalini returned to Oakland after finishing law school to launch a career at Bay Area Legal Aid. There, Rosalini has been able to keep applying the activist spirit that was fostered while at the college more than a decade ago. Emiliano Delgado Olson is the director of the Child Day Schools in Moraga. He has developed in his early career since he's been involved in education since his early career in 2001, and his goal is to provide a positive work environment for children, families, and staff where they can learn and grow. And Kelly Cochran Barham has a master's degree in marriage and family therapy and worked in the mental health field for 10 plus years before switching gears and pursuing her passion for urban farming. Currently, Kelly holds two part-time positions as the Legacy Garden educator, manager, and coordinator, and is the co-founder and director of an after-school program called Plant to Plate. So, switch.
Right. So our first question we have is to please introduce yourself with your name and occupation, and we also invite you to share your pronouns again. And also, like, what is your educational background and how did you find your passion and how has your passion helped you grow personally?
And then you might have to do just a tiny bit of juggling. Oh. Whoever, what, you don't have to go first.
Okay.
Oh, I didn't check my email this morning.
I can go first.
Yes.
Okay. I don't think I need a microphone. I have a pretty loud voice, so I'll just speak right out. Again, my name is Sherry Ellingson. I'm happy to be here. I'm a yoga teacher and a life coach, and my pronouns are she, her, hers. And how did I get here?
Like your background.
Yeah. My background. That's interesting. Okay, so my educational background was in clothing and textiles from San Francisco State University, with an emphasis in marketing. I worked in retail management for about 18 years. I was an assistant buyer, I was a trainer. Didn't love my job, I felt drained. There was a lot of great nuggets about it that I enjoyed. I loved helping people, I helped, I loved the training aspect. And how I ended up on this path had to do more with I got sick. I almost had breast cancer, and cancer runs in my family. So it kind of put me on the holistic path, and I used to practice yoga for years. So I decided to be a yoga teacher. And the life coaching just came out of me noticing so many emotional barriers and so many mental barriers, and I just want to help people. So I got into a life coach training program run by Martha Beck. I don't know if you know her, but yeah, so that's how I ended up here. There's more, but this is a brief version.
Right. Are we just going through with the line?
Yeah.
Okay. All right, so you guys can hear me fine? Okay, yeah, I'm used to projecting my voice because I'm always outside. I'm competing with lots of ambient noise. So my name is Kelly Cochran Barham. My pronouns are she, her, hers. I'm gonna try and make mine brief. I went to school and studied psychology. I went and got a master's in marriage and family therapy, and I practiced marriage and family therapy for 10 plus years in a lot of different venues, mostly community mental health. So working very much in impoverished areas and providing services to those who are on Medi-Cal or Medicaid and wouldn't otherwise have the resources for mental health, which is usually means they have to be in crisis in order to receive treatment. So it was really intense at work, to say the least. And there's a lot, so I was listening to a lot of trauma. And I decided, well, then we rented a place here in the Bay Area, and it had a little patch of grass or ground, and I started to play in it. So I found, so I just sort of dabbled in that a little bit, and then we moved into a bigger place, and I started composting, actually, because it was cheaper. We came to the Bay Area from graduate school, and so we were like, that's ridiculous that you don't, you know, go from a place of not having any money to a place that costs lots of money to live. And so we were skimping everywhere we could. And I thought, well, if I'm not throwing my garbage away, that's another $10 a month we can save. So I started composting and got totally geeked out by soil science. And I just was like, this is fascinating. And the more I got into composting, that just opened, you know, it's this little porthole, and then I started like growing stuff with the compost, and then I was really hooked. How did I get here? Let's see, how can I wrap this up? So then so I found my own therapy in the dirt, let's just put it that way. And then, but I thought, there's no way I can do this for a living. And I couldn't for a while, and I'm sure some of the questions later on will answer this, but I basically just little by little started to teach myself and experiment using the ground I had to work with. And literally that nature became my school and my teacher. And over the course of many years, I actually knew something. And I could not help but want to share that information with other people. I volunteered at my kid's school. That changed the dynamic at that school to the point where the principal was like, I don't want you to go away because I don't have so many problems in my office with kids after recess because they're with you in the garden. And so I have some extra money if you... I was in between jobs, by the way. So I was looking for a job, and... that's what I was doing, just to sort of kill some time, because I don't sit still very well. And I then, anyway, one thing led to another. There was this little nugget of income that led me, and I was like, well, I can do this. And then that led me to developing some more skills. And then that led to St. Mary's. And then that led to me developing my own after-school program with high school student juniors and seniors in partnership with a chef. So, and I'll tell you more about that, I guess, in another question. But, so that's how I ended up here and doing those things. It's just literally one little bit at a time. Yeah.
Can everyone hear me okay? All right, good. So I'm Skylar Rosalini, and my pronouns are he, him. And let's see, my background is always in art and kind of creative field. I thought I wanted to be an artist, but I didn't really know what that looked like at all. And my family was always kind of like, oh, don't do that for a career. Like, you can do that anytime outside of your job and things like that. So, but I also was just very, I don't know, I came to St. Mary's like really not knowing myself very much. So I really kind of didn't know what I wanted to do. And I knew I wanted to do something. I just didn't know what that something was. And I didn't really know like what my future looked like. So I just kind of, you know, one step at a time, just sort of, I came to St. Mary's. I was new to the area, and just got involved in different things on campus, and yeah, just took it one step at a time. And eventually that opened my eyes to like really being involved in activism, particularly around LGBTQ rights. My first year here was when like Gavin Newsom had like the marriage licenses, and that was huge because I never even thought about that before. So, you know, that's kind of where I got my sort of taste of like activism and thinking about advocacy and how that might look after college. And so I, you know, feel like I really started to find my voice here, and that inspired me to go to law school after, which was really hard. And with like kind of an artist sort of background, it's just a very different way of thinking, very different. But it also taught me a lot that it pushed me out of my comfort zone in ways that I think really have helped me grow. And after law school, I mean, it was when the market was terrible for new, it was like the worst time really to graduate from law school, worst time. No jobs for new lawyers because you have no experience. And so I worked a lot of, I did like everything. Any legal job I took, I hustled really hard, got involved with our LGBTQ Bar Association, networked, all that. And then I eventually got a job at a small workers' comp firm, defense side, so like with the insurance companies. And that was kind of, the small firm setting was great because I don't like the sort of big corporate law firm vibe, but it also gave me a lot of experience, and I did learn a lot. But definitely, like as a queer trans person, like not the environment for me. So I met a friend who had this job with Bay Area Legal Aid in their Health Consumer Center, and she talked about the work she was doing, helping primarily low-income families, breaking down barriers to accessing their health care. And she talked about her team and how collaborative they were and how awesome her boss was. And I was like, well, that sounds awesome. I would like to work there. And she was like, well, we have an opening. And so I applied and I didn't get it. But they really liked me a lot. And managing attorney said, you know, email me in a month. And I did promptly. And she was like, let's talk. You know, we are acquiring another nonprofit in Napa County. We want to bring health access up to Napa. And you know, do you want to apply? And so, I did. And I got the job, and I haven't left since. And I love my work. Being a lawyer is hard, but and I took a pay cut with this job. Small firms don't pay amazingly, but I mean more than nonprofit. And I definitely had to make ends meet to make it work. But I was very passionate about the work that I was doing. So. Now I'm here and not working multiple jobs, and you know, yeah, that's
all right. Numbers are still going. I won't need a microphone. My name's Emil or Emiliano Delgado Olson, but I've been working in childcare since 2001. Prior to that, I was a high school kid who had little below average grades. Coming out, I grew up in Oakland area where I grew up around a lot of police, firefighters, just through my family and stuff, and social workers. So I thought I was going to put a magic hat on one day and go out and be in Oakland police and change the world without being passionate or knowing what that entailed. And within a week of doing a ride-along, I decided this is hell on earth. And I'm not going to do this. And I just happened to run into an old friend who had a position at a little preschool. So I went in there as a teacher aide, and they gave me the confidence to go to just Merritt College, community college, and get some early childhood units. And I fell in love with it. And then Just wanted to channel that into like social work, which is similar to what I do now, being a director at a preschool. So I just kind of grew through the ropes there, just through experience and, of course, getting an early childhood education and sociology education. What all changed for me really is I was not closed-minded. Again, I grew up in Oakland and, you know, what I would consider like lower middle class family. But I was naive to the sense of, you know, what type of social injustice exists, and it's quite a bit. It wasn't until I met my wife, who went to Mills College and was opened my eyes to whether it was a conference or situations where I really saw the way that some of you guys are talking about, people tell you not to be, you know, what you want to be, an artist, a teacher, and all these things. But there are ways, which I'm sure we'll get into, to find your passions. And that's when I'm finding I'm 41, so I'm still a kid, but I'm finding that I'm going to change my life into something more where it's going to be more about diversity, inclusion, and you know, just helping others who kind of need that light at the end of the road. So yeah, a little tricky. I will say when I started early childhood, there is a cap, I should say, if you're just going to be a teacher in early childhood. Early childhood education, the field I work in, is more of a stepping stone to be grow into a social worker, a public school teacher, or even more so. I have some teachers who are staying with me until they get their master's and beyond to work at a college, for example. Part of it we talked about is luck of having the nicer landlord, where you don't get the rent hike every month. If you have a significant other, if you have roommates, those kind of things, because we're not we're not all working at Google. But I think more, I'm not working another job, is if you are passionate about what you're doing, there's always, the one thing we did all have in common, we talked about that on the side, is there is always a way to do this. Whether you have kids, family, significant other or not, there are ways to, you don't want to be, what I'm trying to say is like doing a position that you don't care for. I think we all kind of touched on that. Finding that passion, whether it pays a little bit less, doesn't really matter in the end. You know, there's ways to cut back on other things that you realize you didn't really need if you're doing something you're passionate about.
I mean, when I was applying for my current position, yeah, the offer letter, I looked at it and thought, okay, can I do this? can I actually live off of this? And it was tough. I took a second job while I worked. While I started out at Bay Legal, and I just made it work because I just loved the work that I was doing. I was learning about healthcare, which is something that I didn't even have for part of my life. And, you know, no one really teaches you about that at all. And here I was like learning about it and advising people about it. And I was working with a team, that I just really love working with, and again, had management that's been just very supportive and also very collaborative, I just knew that this, like, if I'm going to be an attorney, this is my ideal job. This kind of checks off the boxes. So I was going to do whatever I needed to do to keep this job and to sustain myself. So yeah, I did work. I did like Instacart, which was not fun at all. Like to buy my own groceries. I was delivering people's groceries. And you know, it was interesting. But I mean, it gave me some extra cash, you know, to keep living in Oakland and going to work and doing what I enjoy doing. So I definitely did that for a while. And then, you know, eventually when you get more experience and you especially if, like, you know, networking and nurturing relationships in, you know, the various fields that you're in, you know, you start to build community and you start to build connections and, you know, your career will take you places that you just don't know before you get into it. You just have no idea. And then these doors kind of open. And, you know, now, I'm not like rolling in the dough here, you know, but I mean, I can pay my bills. Like I pay my bills and I took myself on a vacation a month ago and it was awesome. And I didn't feel like put out by it. And, but I, that was step by step. It did not happen overnight. It took so many jobs, horrible jobs, to get there. But I just knew, like, if I just kept my eye, like, where I wanted to be and just made sure that I was moving in that direction, you know, that I would get to where I'm at. So a lot of patience, hard work, focus.
Yeah, I want to say, before I say anything else, that I recognize my social location when I'm in the context of, like, what I'm sharing with you, in that I'm white, female, petite, and partnered. So there, and because of some of those identities, because they were how they are received by the rest of society, opportunities and doors have been available to me that wouldn't necessarily otherwise be. For example, you know, I can walk into my kid's elementary school and propose something to the principal, who's also a white female, and I am not at all intimidating or threatening, or she's not going to think that I'm going to abuse kids. That's not something that is afforded to everybody in society. So I want to just say, before I say anything else, that's a very real dynamic that's at play. And that I'm aware of when I'm saying, well, just do this. I don't want to make it sound like what applies, you know, what I might say or suggest or be available and an opportunity for one person be true for everybody. So now I'll talk about how we made it work. So it helped that I was partnered, and my partner has a very steady, consistent job. We're not rolling in it. But it did allow me at the time, because we also had small children, for us to scale back hard, and then for me to explore my other interests, as opposed to me staying in the mental health field and just grinding it out. Mental health field doesn't pay well either. So we were used to being, you know, the miserly, very frugal. And got really good at entertaining ourselves on the cheap. And so, but still, housing is exorbitant in the Bay Area. So how are we going to actually just pay rent? But that said, I did a ton of side hustles. I worked a bunch of different jobs so that I could do the one job I really loved. And that job became my therapy. Like, that fueled me. I loved it so much that I had energy to go and do all these other side hustles, one of which was to write grants to pay myself for that other job. And that one I didn't get paid for at all. That was literally a volunteer job, and that helped pay me for the job I really wanted to keep, while I was doing some landscaping work, while I was catering, while I was, God, I had one year, I had so many jobs that taxes was just ridiculous. My partner was like, okay, you can't have more than 6 jobs, because otherwise we're going to have to hire an accountant, and that's going to offset all of the money that we're trying to save, just to factor in all the taxes. Like he said, Skylar said, I was really focused. And what's interesting, though, about all the side hustles was they then became, I didn't know it at the time, but they became the networking seeds that the Plant to Plate program grew out of. So I was growing a lot of food in my garden and in the school garden. That food then became, because I had so much of it, the ingredients that I used when I was catering that I did not have to pay for, but I could charge for. Mm-hmm. but I wasn't having to, that wasn't an invoice I had to write. It was just I went to the backyard, got it, and then incorporated that into the recipes. And then those contacts with those chefs then became the network that then became the partnership that I'm in now with the after school program. So it's a plant to plate is a, we use an urban garden and a professional kitchen to teach job and life skills to juniors and seniors in Richmond, California. And we use, I met my partner in that endeavor while I was actually putting in his kitchen garden at his kitchen that I met when I was at the elementary school because we were at a volunteer event together. He was volunteering his time, I was volunteering my time, and he saw my produce, and he's a chef. So he comes over, he's like, that's a really beautiful Swiss chard. And I'm like, yes, it is. Thank you, babe. I'm like, you flatter me. Yeah. And that's how we started the conversation. So I could never have predicted that. I just was doing what I loved, and I was trying to figure out how to make it work. And I also, like, my job is, like, what I would do for free. Like, I love it. So it's my hobby. So I don't spend anything on entertainment, really. I don't have to. I do now because we can sort of afford to go to the movies or we can. But it is one of those things where I'm getting my needs met through what I was doing. But it wasn't. I mean, I was exhausted. I won't lie to you. It was really a lot of work. And at the time that I met the chef, I was burnt. I was like, I'm done. I'm not. St. Mary's had offered me this job. I thought, I was like, finally, I don't have to grant write to get paid, to get myself paid. And I said to him, and he was like, I want to do something in the community. I want to, but I'm not getting any traction. He's a businessman. I've been in the nonprofit sector forever. I had a network base. I knew I could pull off a program. But I told him, I am so burnt from beg, borrowing, and stealing. I can't do this. And he said the magic words. He said, don't worry about the money. And I went, okay, let's sit down. Let's have a chat. And then we're 4 years into the program, so with a new cohort. So that's kind of how that happened.
Thank you. So yes to everything that they said as well. For me, I'm also a substitute school teacher, so I do that part-time. I do that a couple days a week, and that comes from me wanting to be a teacher at a really, really young age. But I know it's not enough for me to be a classroom teacher. So I do that, but in addition, I have my coaching and I teach workshops. I teach yoga, so I have a lot of public access. I get to know people, I meet people, there's ways that I network. And I love what I do so much that it doesn't feel like work to me. It's just, I don't know how to explain it. It feels amazing. I feel alive, like I've never been alive when I had a corporate job. So I would probably never go back to that. And yes, you do have to cut some things to be able to do what you love. But I wouldn't do it any other way. You know, it lights you up. It fuels you for everything. And that's priceless. So follow what you love. And in addition to yoga teaching and being a part-time school teacher sub, I'm also a personal stylist. And that comes into my self-care package where you are taking care of yourself. Your closet is a clutter. I have to come in. I go in and I help clients declutter. They get ready for interviews, special events. You know, it's the whole mind, body, emotional health.
So our next question is, what inspired you to pursue your passion and what resources helped you? And if so, what sacrifices did you have to make and or what pushback did you face?
Pushback is, I think my whole career change and my college change, have to backtrack really quick. When I started college, I went in as a business admin major, pre-law, wanted to go to Cal for law school. I took a law class and I was like, this is not me. Like, so I went into clothing and textiles and marketing. And I don't know, it just, everything led to something else, correct? And I'm sorry, I kind of lost track of the, okay. So the backlash kind of, right? A backlash? Sacrifices. Backlash, my family, being a conservative Persian family who believes in education, who believes in, oh, you need to be a lawyer, a doctor, maybe a teacher. Otherwise, no. When my father was alive, this is what he said to me. He said, you either get into Stanford or Cal, or we're not paying for your education. You're going to move out. You're going to pay your own bills. And when my father passed away, I went to San Francisco State. I changed my major, was in corporate for a long time. Then I went on this holistic path of helping people. And again, family pushback. I lost a lot of friendships, I have to tell you, in the last, like about 5-6 years ago when I started on this path. My life changed. I wasn't partying. I wasn't doing some of the things that my friends were doing anymore. And that was a pushback on its own. And did I want to stay on a path that wasn't true to me and do the things that no longer fit? Or did I want to pursue things that I loved and be with people that I enjoyed? And I had to say goodbye to a lot of people in my life. But I'm so happy now because I'm meeting better people that are suited for me, better suited for me. And my family has just accepted it. So, and they will eventually. And sacrifices, yeah, there's a lot of sacrifices. Like, I have to make my cars on the older side. I have to keep getting it fixed. I don't have the budget right now to get a new car. But you know what? It works. It works. So I have freedom in other ways. And it's great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, so I would echo a lot of that. I would have to say that a lot of the, so you go to school, and I did, you know, I invested a great deal of time and energy into my identity as a mental health professional. Mm-hmm. So the sacrifices I had to make were in some ways really internal. I had to change the narrative I was telling about myself, and I had to change the perception or the story that I spent all this money and I spent all this time and now I have a master's and I have a license and you did all this. You ate that whole elephant and now you're not going to use it? Nobody else really was telling me, like, that's crazy, but I was telling me that was crazy. And so the other thing, too, about it is when you aren't, because, you know, what I'm giving you a really fast track version, but this was a lot of time. This was over 10 years that this developed. And in that 10 years or more, I was not living up to my own expectations of clout, you know, of the working, you know, I was like, you know, feminist, I'm mature, I'm not going to meet the stereotypical female definition, and I'm going to break the ceiling, and I'm going to do all this stuff, and now I'm like not working, I'm working this part-time job at my kid's school, I look so homemaker-esque, cooking my own food and canning, and I was like, I can't, you know, it was like I had my own little identity crisis around, I love it, I value it, but I don't think the rest of the world does, or at least I was saying, then in many ways they weren't valuing it, and I had to be like, where is my internal core value system of what's important vis-a-vis what the world says is important? And so, and that was not an easy process. That wasn't quick. It wasn't simple. There was a lot of things that I would do and things I would struggle with and fights I would pick with my poor husband when it was really had nothing to do with whatever it is that I picked a fight over, but it was because I wasn't okay with where I was in life. And so I had to sacrifice, I had to sort of die to myself. Mm-hmm. I had to compost myself in order for that to rise again, for that fertile ground really to be able to then grow into something that was really alive and thriving and able to nurture and feed and educate. And now, you know, and it was like, this is what I was really, this is, I can be a mental health therapist. And I would be happy, I could do that. I could go back to that. But this, I'm actually combining in the two jobs that I'm doing now at St. Mary's and Plant to Plate, I am in every way using that degree in a just a very non-traditional form. That nobody else in the field would probably go, yeah. I mean, some would maybe, but they, and now there's a field called ecotherapy, like, go figure. And I was like, there wasn't that when I was in school. And my husband actually asked, he says, what's your next reinvention? Like, what are you going to do next? And I was like, I don't know yet. Although I had a brainchild in the shower the other day, and I was like, oh, that might be it. But it was because I was willing to do that soul work. And it. So when I talk about sacrifices, really, there were a lot of financial sacrifices. You know, we didn't eat out. We didn't take fancy vacations. We're not flying to Europe. We're... But, like, I don't really feel like I need that in my life. I'm not pining away for the next getaway because I wake up thrilled to do what I do every day. And that's what, you know, it's all worth it, even if I don't get to go to Europe, you know. So, yeah, so those are more of the sacrifices, I would say.
All right, so what inspired me to pursue my passion? So, I mean, there are a few things that, it's funny when, you know, again, when I interviewed for my job, they asked me, you know, so why do you want to work, why do you want to do this work? And, you know, my answer is always, well, I want to help people, which is true. That's a true answer. But I, like, not even until, like, the past year or two, I haven't really sat, like, really thought about that answer. And, you know, I think about it, and, you know, what inspired me is really, like, I think of my mom, who is, like, a single mom and definitely suffers from, like, a lot of mental health issues and growing up around that. And, you know, watching how, you know, there were times where she relied on public benefits to, like, sustain herself with two kids. And I think about, you know, if those resources weren't around and how so many families do need those resources to sustain themselves. And I think about, you know, I think about, you know, as early as 4 and knowing that I was trans, but not even having the language to even articulate that and communicate that. And, like, going so many years, like, just trying to figure that out. You know, things like that really inspire me to do the work that I do. I mean, just on a general point, you know, serving marginalized communities, but also, like, specifically doing healthcare work, just watching how healthcare access disproportionately impacts marginalized communities. And it's just, it's surreal. It's surreal that I am out at my work and, like, I have a supportive work, you know, that's supportive of my identity, but I get to do work for other trans people. Like, I, like, recently we just did a name and gender marker change clinic for youth, for trans youth whose parents, are helping them change their name and gender marker. Like, that's very surreal for me because I look at these kids and I just, like, kind of see myself, but they know so much more than I knew at that age. Or, like, you know, with healthcare, you know, doing cases with, you know, trans people who are being denied services because of their identity, and I get to litigate those cases, and it's just, it's very full circle in a way. So I think I probably went off on a tangent, but the resources that helped me, like I said, I mean, networking and just really working hard is what got me through. I mean, kind of saying yes to jobs that didn't sound great, but helped me at least get some income to pay my bills and my rent, and just making sure that I was fostering those relationships that I was making along the way, getting involved with organization, you know, volunteering at a lot of things that I was interested in, and again, building those relationships so that, you know, later on they'd think of me for an opportunity. You know, that those were the resources that, you know, really helped me. And let's see, the sacrifices and pushback. I mean, sacrifices, I mean, law school is, it is 24/7 for 3 to 4 years, depending on, you know, which program you do. I mean, you, like, that is your life. And, but as like miserable as that process was, I always tell people when I do these panels, that, you know, I'm not really passionate about law. I'm passionate about people and communities. Like, that's what I'm passionate about. And law is just my channel to serve communities. And there are so many ways that you can serve the community. And so, I mean, I definitely devoted, 3 years of just like no life and just studying and stress, in a very conservative environment. I think that might just be a law school thing. I think it just tends to be a more conservative setting. That was definitely very difficult. There were like 4 queer people in the whole law school, which was different coming from St. Mary's, which, I mean, you know, it's different than like, you know, Berkeley maybe, but I mean, there were more, like, I had more friends and community here, like a lot, that was awesome. And then I went to law school and it was so different. So that was tough. But it was also kind of a blessing in a way, because when I went to law school, I was in just a horrible place, just terrible place, emotionally, and law school really forced me to just choose myself. Like, are you gonna do this for yourself? Or are you gonna, like, you know, kind of mess around on these like toxic relationships and things like that? So, law school really demanded me, you know, for these 3 years. I couldn't afford to not dedicate that time. So it was kind of, it worked out really in the long run, because again, I learned so much about myself. I chose myself and applied myself to do something for myself and to eventually be where I am today, to give back to the communities around me. Let's see, pushback. I mean, there's definitely pushback if you're like not white, cis, and straight. Like, there's a lot of pushback, because the legal profession is, it's 80% white, and it's, I mean, I would think there's significantly less LGBT folks in the legal profession. And I mean, at my job before my current position, it was hard. I clearly made my boss uncomfortable. He just like really didn't know what to do with me. But I was always so quiet and just did my work. So I don't know. It was very strange. I could just feel that discomfort. And he really made me feel like I just didn't belong in this profession. And I almost left law. I almost quit. I was like, maybe I'm just not good enough to be an attorney. This just isn't my path. I should just do something else. And then this opportunity came up, and I just thought, like, this is where I want to be. And I'm so glad I didn't quit, because I love my work. I love what I do. And now I have space to focus to my other passions that I've mentioned before, which was like art. I have space to actually create art again and return back to some of my original passions. So
that's cool. That's awesome. My definitely not that heavy. My parents were, again, I mentioned, I think earlier, both in some form of education, social work. So there was a strong support system for any profession I would choose. Their worry, of course, was you're in the Bay Area, you want to start a family, and you are going to get $15 an hour at the time. So that was more of their concerns, like how are you going to take care of your kid when they get sick, that kind of thing. But you know, it all worked out, and they were still, you know, supportive anyway. It's actually interesting, my backlash wasn't until I was in the field, and I was very, again, innocent, naive, however you want to look at it. Stereotypically, males are predominantly predators to families who are, you know, when they see a male out of place. So what's this male doing in early education? So I would overhear these families on tours ask, even, I was surprised, even when I worked at Head Start in Oakland and low income, middle income, and then here where it's, you know, upper middle or more, you know, they'll be on a tour visiting schools and, you know, what's his deal? And I could hear them ask, like, does he change diapers? Does he change children? Which, for my own protection, I made sure I never did. So I would say it was the only backlash, and I guess not changing diapers isn't really a sacrifice, but yeah, you know, it was their own sacrifice, I guess. My co-teacher sacrifice, yeah. Yeah, so that was probably the oddest thing where, and again, I just didn't feel that way because I'm not a predator. I have my own children, and I was going to be a police officer, and I was going to work in the child abuse unit, which dealt with those people, which I don't think I would have been very good at. But so I think that was the hardest part, if I had to just kind of wrap it all up. And the backlash, too, would then spill over to some of the other teachers, like, well, how come he doesn't get to deal with, you know, things like diapers or changing a child, you know? And then, yeah, so again, just this nice cycle of just unfortunate situation. But overall, you know, it what makes me passionate about it is just I love, I think you guys all touched on this, is helping other people, other families, especially those. I do a lot of volunteer work still with low-income families where I grew up, and you know, helping everyone and helping families grow, whether it's them getting free school supplies or you know, trying to get more minorities and women in tech, which my wife deals with, and supporting that. That's where I find the reward. And those two things, funny, I'm more passionate about, and I don't get paid for. I get, you know, put in the ringer for, actually. I get the back end work with that. Whereas teaching is awesome, but I'm finding more and more it's, even now being a director, it's kind of, you know, isolated to that one community, where if I'm doing something in the city of Oakland, it's branching out to a whole community and inspiring, you know, one family to then spread the word to others and things. And same thing with conferences, so, yeah.
Before you ask the next question, can I pick on Emil to elaborate a little bit more? Part of the reason I was excited to, and by the way, I know a few people had to leave, but we'll keep going until 2:30 because we're gonna preserve the whole conversation and reach a broader audience that way. But part of the reason I was really excited to have Emil among the panelists is because we don't hear a lot of men who are going to take up a job like working in a preschool, and I think it's great when we can broaden our template, yes, or make definitely a new one altogether. So you mentioned the pushback, and I wondered if you could just talk about kind of like elaborate on how you dealt with it, because you have to hear like chatter among your colleagues who are thinking right, you're not pulling your weight, and then there's right, these families, and then
I would say the colleague part didn't bother me as much because I always, especially in the beginning because I was younger and new to this, I always had in the back of my mind, like, Emil, don't ever be alone with these kids. Like, you can't be alone if they're, you know, if they're doing, if I can, like in a room like this, but if, you know, there's a bathroom here, I always made sure there's a teacher if the kid was changing or something, another adult witness, because my fear was, what if this kid goes home with a mark, or what if this kid has, you know, lack of better term, like their relatives doing something to them. Ideally, a family will not blame someone at home. They're going to say, oh, there's a male teacher at, you know, Child Day School Moraga or wherever I was working at the time, and that was my, I think I kind of stuck to that more as my MO rather than worrying so much about my colleagues. Because once they saw that I could do, you know, the curriculum, the teaching, that my supervision was, you know, excellent, all those other things, all those other, you know, boxes were checked, then I wasn't as concerned. This school I'm working at now is small enough where when I was teaching there, it was okay. You know, now that I'm directing, it's definitely a little different. But where the the head starts, there were just a lot of parents who weren't educated in the in any field, coming from places where they had their own environments growing up disrupted or you know, not good life experience. So I was more worried about the backlash, I think, there.
Yeah. Thanks.
Yeah, so our next question kind of talks about some of the topics the panelists had an opportunity to expand upon, but the first part of the question was, how does the intersection of your gender, race, or identity impact or show up in your work? So some of you talked about that, and if you have, then what barriers are you still facing or trying to overcome in your work that's in the beyond?
Let's see. Well, I think there's an assumption that social justice spaces, you know, must be aware of, you know, certain ways that maybe they're upholding, like, just kind of problematic frameworks. So for example, you know, I love where I work. I feel very grateful to be where I am, and I feel very valued, and I feel like I also contribute to the place that I work at. And they definitely were not very aware of trans people. And again, I think there's like an assumption that a social justice space might be, but oftentimes not. And so I definitely, when I got my job there, I identified as more non-binary at the time. And my managing attorney at the time did not understand what that meant. And I mean, it was, you know, very nice, right? But just like, that part of my identity was invisible. It was invisible to people. I looked different. I appeared different. I sounded different. My build was different. So I was perceived differently. I was perceived as basically a cis woman who was gay. So that was definitely challenging to deal with, because that was not my identity, and that was very triggering for me, because it really triggered a lot of dysphoria for me. I feel lucky to be in a space that is receptive to that education. That is not the case for a lot of places, and I think it's important to be upfront about that. My previous job, I definitely did not feel safe talking about my gender identity. My solution to that was to get out, and because it was not safe. And so it's a hard thing to negotiate. And I really respect, however, somebody, you know, regardless of their identity, chooses to navigate that, because it's very hard. So like I said, my work has been very receptive. I have a team specifically that has been just awesome. So I think when my colleagues model, you know, the behavior and like take on the education, like the sort of burden of educating for me, like about pronouns and making assumptions about people's pronouns or how they identify, that has been very helpful, because other people see that and then they model it, and then it spreads, you know, throughout. And then a lot of it, I'm our outreach coordinator for our health unit, so I do a lot of outreach. Because I love doing that, and I do love, providing that education. So through that outreach and that becoming more visible at, you know, my organization, again, they've learned a lot on how to be more inclusive of transgender people and queer people. and we're still working on it. I mean, there's still work to be done. But I think what I like is that they're receptive to that education. They're open to that education, and they don't put it on me to, you know, have the answer. They don't, you know, target me to educate them. They take it on themselves. But I can't say that for every workspace, because many organizations are not like that, even social justice spaces. So I just think it's important to be transparent about that too.
Yeah. Can you read the question again? I think I understand it, but.
So how does the intersection of your gender and or race impact or show up in your work? And then, if you've kind of already addressed that, what barriers are you facing in that aspect, and how are you trying to overcome?
Okay, yeah. All right, so I mentioned a little bit about my own internal sexism, I think, about wanting to break the stereotypes, and then realizing that at least to the outside world, I'm fitting right into the stereotype of a gardening, you know, white woman who, and however, I took it back, like, rather than why I do this because, or, you know, why I'm gardening and cooking, and it took it to a level of where it's really about community outreach. It's a political act. What motivates me to grow food organically is about resistance to the man and corporate ag and all of those things that try and control our very sustenance that keeps us alive, and resilience, so that, like, we have some stakeholdership, some ownership in that which keeps you alive, and the education to know how to do that. So knowledge being power. And so on the outside surface, it looks like I'm just being, you know, very stereotypically fitting right in line. And that was why I resisted it for so long. That was why if you had told me when I was in college that this is what I would be doing, I would have laughed you out of the room, because I was not going to be like my mother. I was not going to be, you know, the housewife who did not, like, push and resist all the stereotypes that was expected of her. And then came full circle, kind of like what you were saying, and here I am, but with a whole different motivation and zeal than what my mother was even afforded to have. No, not dissing on my mom at all. But, you know, we stand on the shoulders of those who came before us, and she wasn't as given as much a voice as I now have. And that my, you know, I wasn't, that my girls now have. But I do get some pushback, or I get a lot of surprise when I pull out power tools and start using them. And I love it when, in fact, oh, she left. So Maya, I get put a power tool in Maya's hand the other day. Was it Maya? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes. And she then said, you know, I'm outing her a little bit here, but she was like, oh, my dad would never believe I'm doing this. And I'm like, yes. That's right. Power tools aren't just, well, they make them mostly for men, so that's why they're awfully heavy. But they are, you know, that pushing those boundaries and just sort of grappling with the ever-present prejudice and stereotypes that play out, but really not letting it stop you. You know, like, I notice the tree tremor guys were here on campus, and I show up, and you know, granted, they come from a culture, they're very strong, they are tree tremors, and they come from a culture where women, you know, don't belong in that space, and they're like, are you lost? They're looking at me like I'm lost. I'm like, no, this is my space, and I start putting stuff away, and they're like, no, we can do that, and I'm just like, I can lift this, I'm thankfully very able-bodied, and I'm like, I'll just move this stuff out of your way. But there is that sort of like, well, we're just trying to figure out what's our role here, because I'm not behaving in a way that somebody is expecting me to, and so there's that dynamic. And I think it's always, you know, present, and then you just don't let it stop you. Like, it's gonna, you just plow forward anyway, because you're living your authentic self and you're living wholeheartedly. I'll stop with that.
Thank you. I'm gonna be brief. I have faced a lot of different, you know, sexism, racism, for different things, you know, as I've grown on my path. But I think right now the biggest challenge is that people don't know what a life coach is, what a life coach does for a living. And there's no, they don't see the value in it. So I think in the Bay Area, we're more open and we are aware of it, but trying to talk to people outside of the Bay Area or even in the Bay Area, it's challenging to describe what it is that a life coach does. And they think that it's advice giving, which it's not. I'm here to help with the thought processes that are keeping you back or blocked and help you overcome your challenges. And it's not my job to tell you what you have to do. It's something that I create for you, and it's creating space. So that's the biggest pushback and challenge with what I'm doing right now.
Right, so a last question, let's be like a little brief maybe, or like using your own experience, how would you advise SMC students who face the question of choosing their passion or a realistic job?
I think it's something we've been talking about. I would say follow your passion, do what you love, what inspires you, that motivates you. The money's gonna come, it's gonna follow. And if you need to have random little jobs, if you need to be a server, if you need to be a bartender, if you need to go be a substitute school teacher, whatever, you do it. But you're going to fall down many times, and it's about resiliency. It's about picking yourself up. It's having that big picture, like, this is a big picture. This is what I want. This is what helps me get up and do the small jobs to be able to do what you love. That's my biggest advice that I can give.
Yeah, I would say make them the same, because they can be. Lower your standards of living. We don't all have to consume as much as we are. All those extras are just that. They are extras. You don't have to have a brand new car.
It doesn't buy you happiness,
does
right?
Does it? No, you really can't.
Yeah.
Granted, we haven't talked about poverty at length, but there is, you know, we're talking about a baseline. We're talking about, do you have enough food to eat? Do you have shelter? Do you have, once those things are covered, everything else is extra. Yes. But we have, our society, Western in particular, has really, put us to sleep about what the extras are and what they aren't. You got to figure that out for yourself. That's not something I or anybody else could tell you. But I do think that stack your functions. Like, that's a permaculture term. It's like, make one effort count for several things. Like, I'm doing something that I love, so my mental health and my health care are covered. I mean, I don't have to go to the doctor because I'm eating really well, because I'm growing what I'm doing, and I'm doing out in the community and educating and sharing. You can actually create these little capitalistic, rogue capitalism or anti-capitalistic ventures where you're sharing what you have versus buying and selling. So I'd say echo what she said, in that when you are happy, people want to be around you. People want you to stay around you. So they'll figure out a way, because sometimes it's a matter of, you know, job or no job, is do they like you? Are you pleasant to be around? And if you're happy, you're going to be pleasant to be around. They'll hire you vis-a-vis, even if you haven't got all the skills that the person who came before you in the interview process, because they just didn't seem like they weren't happy about life. I stopped there.
I would definitely echo what they've mentioned already, and I would add that, at least for me, if I'm doing something I don't like, I don't do well at it. I'm bad. Like, I suck at, like, yeah, you don't want me doing, like, workers' comp defense. Like, I'm not good for that. But it taught me enough to get me into doing healthcare access, into working with communities that I wanted. That's why I went to law school. And now I'm at my best when I'm doing work that's in line with my values, mm-hmm. and in line with, yeah, what I want to do in an environment I want to be in. And I would add, when I feel safe in the space that I'm in. I mean, all of those things matter. And it allows you to have the space to devote to getting really good at it. Because when you're good at it, then, you know, that also markets you and makes you competitive, mm-hmm. in the market that you're in. So it's beneficial on so many fronts, mental health wise, and it feeds your soul, but it also, you know, makes you kind of a star in that field. And I think, yeah, passion and realistic job. I don't know that those words are kind of funny. I think that they're the same. It's the same. But yeah, you may have to, you know, take on some jobs or kind of go through some growing pains definitely along the way. So it's worth it though.
Yeah. And they all build character, all those growing pains.
Absolutely. Yeah. I would reiterate everything that was just said. And I would simply add that, remember the beginning, I said I was going to be a police officer, I was going to change the world, put this magic hat on. I went on that ride along, though, and I would highly suggest whatever fields you're interested in, maybe just write it down in your brain or on a pad, those top three fields you may want, you know, go observe. If you want early education, come on by anytime. I'll leave my card at the table. But if you think you want high school, I have connections in the community. I can help you guys out. So, feel free to take my card if it's law, those types of things. You know, reach out into your own community. I know Moraga's small, but a lot of different professions are going on here. And I would highly recommend observing those maybe top three professions you're interested in to make sure that is something you will continue to be passionate about after you see, you know, a three-year-old throw up on the carpet and everybody run in a circle and there's only two teachers. So, you know, that... Then you may decide you're going to be something else. So, yeah.
So before we wrap, I know I just wanted to throw one other thing in there really quick. I can hold this. So as many of you know, the Women's Resource Center changed to the Center for Women and Gender Equity so that we have more room to talk about things across the gender spectrum. So I'm really appreciating this. Kelly, it's been really interesting to talk about hear about the leaning into something that is so stereotypical, but finding your way and renaming that and owning it. And I know you opted out of the last question, Emil, because you thought you covered it. But I also was thinking about the other social piece, because some of my male-identifying students that I talk with can be persuaded out of a field like education or early childhood, not only because of like the predator stereotype that we have to debunk, but also because in some ways maybe it's emasculating, or people they have to deal with familial pressure, cultural pressure. So could you talk about that piece, and anytime you had to kind of hold your own? Give you an example. Somebody's partner had said, oh, well, she wears the pants in the family because you're doing this job, and then that, mm-hmm. like, it, mm-hmm. yeah, so these
and we,
kinds of things.
That's very true. I should have brought that up, because we are in, and I have been just naturally accused of, like, accused is wrong, because I don't care what anybody is, so, but anyway, but parents have naturally assumed I was gay, and they didn't know any other form, they wouldn't know what bi or trans or anything is, because they were, if they're thinking that, they're obviously, you know, let's not go there. Anyway, they, you know, so it was automatically perceived. I personally didn't care, you know, I mean, eventually they realized I have a wife, I have a, you know, at the time, a son, daughter, those things, you know, attending the school. And I think that part, looking back, the 22, 23-year-old me should have done more and stood up for myself in all those situations. I didn't know what I know now. Now I also, like I mentioned, volunteer in other sectors too, where it's the opposite issue, where why is a Native American woman, this person starting Native American Women in Computing, there's no Native Americans left. You know, she would hear things like that. Women aren't in computer science. What is she even trying to do? You know, those type of stereotypes. It's in every field. And I had the luxury, which would differentiate what my wife would have, is I'm a white-looking male, even though my dad is actually the Canadian immigrant, English immigrant, and my mom is the legal Mexican in the house. But still, it, you know, this is Bay Area. So I think going back to that is, you know, I had the luxury of being a white-looking male going home each day. I was still, I had the comfort of my own bubble where it didn't really affect me as much as what I'm trying to say, where my wife, it had a profound effect, and that's why she's, you know, empowering other women now. That's her field. She's in the nonprofit sector and STEM. So, you know, I would say, honestly, for me, it didn't affect, but I could see how that pushes men away from trying to be teachers, especially anything prior to middle school. I wish there was more outreach type things for that field, but unfortunately there's not.
And you said your wife's identity is, or her professional identity is in STEM?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Any last minute questions, anyone?
Okay, well, let's thank our facilitators and all of our panelists. And I want all the panelists to know too, and facilitators, this will be amplified and shared out with the whole community. So even though we have a small group here, this matters. So thank you for carving out the time to be here.